Hey, here's something you should know. Some experts estimate that up to 77% of the population has some level of speaking anxiety. I actually thought it was higher than that. Strong communication is a critical skill for success, which is why I'd like to recommend a podcast I know you're going to love called Think Fast, Talk Smart, produced by the folks at Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the number one career podcast in over 95 countries, and here's why. Each week, Stanford lecturer Matt Abrahams, who, by the way, has been on this podcast a couple of times, Matt sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you improve all kinds of skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression, keeping your nerves in check while speaking in front of crowds. I mean, there's a reason this show has over 42 million downloads and counting. You'll hear from people like neuroscientist Andrew Huberman on how to manage speaking anxiety, speechwriter and best-selling author Daniel Pink on how to take risks in your communication, and psychologist Kelly McGonigal on how to harness that nervous energy to fuel powerful presentations. All that and so much more is available on Think Fast, Talk Smart. So, what are you waiting for? Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube, and you can tell them I sent you. Today on Something You Should Know, how some billboards can actually mess up your driving. Then, understanding optimism and all the reasons to worry less and be more optimistic.
What we found, what research has found, is that 85% of the time, things that you worry about don't actually happen. And when they do, you're better equipped to handle them than you actually gave yourself credit for. And this is a really important point for people to take home.
Also, how driving with a cold could be worse than driving drunk. And algorithms. They make recommendations for everything you buy online. But is that a good thing?
There's so much frictionlessness on the internet now that just encourages you to just go with that first recommendation. It works for some things. In other places, I think it's made us into worse consumers.
All this today on Something You Should Know. If you employ people, you know that finding the right person to fill a job opening can be daunting. And you know, most people I know who run a business don't really have a proven system to do this. It can be real hit or miss, which is why if you're hiring, you need Indeed. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Indeed it's a whole hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates and find them fast. So what I love about Indeed is when you use it, you get this feeling of confidence that, yeah, this is the way to find the right people. You're not winging it or just sorting through resumes hoping to find someone. And Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from you. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. There's so many reasons to use Indeed, and there are so many reasons not to do this on your own. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/something. Just go to Indeed.com/something right now. That helps to support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/something. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Something you should know. Fascinating intel. The world's top experts. And practical advice you can use in your life. Today, Something You Should Know with Mike Carruthers.
Hello. Welcome to Something You Should Know. I'm one of those people who likes to drive. I've always liked to drive. And as a good driver, I know that one of the most important rules of driving is to keep your eyes on the road. But that can be difficult when you're distracted by, say, a billboard. And it turns out that certain billboards are more distracting and potentially dangerous than others. A study showed that billboards can affect how you drive depending on the message on the billboard. The study discovered that drivers tend to speed up after passing billboards with enticing messages or images, such as cash or fame or sex appeal. Depressing billboards were dangerous too. After passing billboards with negative words and images, such as abuse, stress, prison, or war, drivers had a tendency to slow down and drift from their lane. All these things can cause accidents. Of course, any kind of distraction is risky when you're driving, but it appears to be an even larger risk when the message that you're distracted by is emotional. And that is something you should know. It's always fascinated me how two people can see the world and life and situation so differently, depending on whether they're an optimist or a pessimist. Is the glass half full or half empty? It would seem that being an optimist would be easier, but then a pessimist might say, well, just looking at the bright side of life isn't realistic. Bad things happen. The world can be a dark place, and you have to expect that. Well, regardless of where your beliefs are, I'd like you to listen to Sue Varma. She's a board-certified psychiatrist in private practice and a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at New York University. She's author of a book called Practical Optimism: The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being. Hi, Sue. Welcome to Something You Should Know.
Hi, Michael. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me today.
So let's start by just, if you would explain from your perspective as a psychiatrist and somebody who has studied this, what is an optimist?
Yeah, so an optimist is somebody who naturally tends to envision a favorable outcome when all possible outcomes are possible. And some of us are born with this quality, and then some of us actually have to learn it. That was the most interesting part of my journey and research into optimism, is that while there are some people who naturally see the glass half full, the rest of us have the ability to get there through certain skills and techniques.
So why do we have this difference? Why is the glass half full for some people and half empty for others?
You know, it might be intuitive to think that optimism is genetic, or that you're born with it, right? And that is true. And what I was fascinated by is that researchers have found that there is potentially a genetic association with optimism, that there are these genes that code for the oxytocin receptor gene. And we might have heard about oxytocin, the cuddle and bonding hormone, something that mothers have when bonding with babies, that friends have, that partners, romantic partners have when they spend time with each other, have intimacy. But what's interesting is that these genes actually code for social skills, emotional regulation skills, and that is something we can work on. So the reality is that only 25% of optimism is genetic. The rest of it is learned and within our control if we can do certain things right.
It would also seem real normal and obvious that if you grew up in a household where everybody was pessimist, that you would likely be one too. If your parents saw the glass half empty, if everything was a problem, if nothing went right, and you heard that over and over again, seems like that would get hammered into your brain and you would believe the same thing.
Absolutely. And family environment, and also like the neighborhood in which we grew up. So we actually know that, for example, when you look at kids and you take them from, let's say, a lower income neighborhood, and you put them, they move their family into a higher income neighborhood, or even getting bused into schools where students have higher income, this changes the way they see the world. They see the world as being possible. They see success as being probable. And it really boosts a sense of self-efficacy, which is an important part of optimism. So while family environment plays a role, genetics plays a role, but so does our peer support system. And also just seeing, having positive role models around us also makes a big difference for optimism.
It does seem, and you hear people talk about this all the time, that the negativity bias of life, that when things go wrong, you notice it more than when things go right. And then that reinforces your belief that the world sucks and everybody's mean and you can't get anywhere. And what about that?
For sure. And I think that it's protective on some level to have a negativity bias. Look, our brain's job is to keep us alive. It's our job to keep us happy. And this is an important thing. If you recognize that my brain wants to protect me, it's responsible for my survival. So it's going to look for danger, right? The problem is that when you're consistently looking for danger, your mind shuts off to the possibility of beautiful things happening. So when I talk about optimism, in no way am I saying, you know, it's enough to want, to wish, to hope for good things to happen. Absolutely, you need to make it happen. But also recognize that it's not enough to actively work on boosting your optimism. You actively have to be aware of your own pessimism, including your own negativity bias, which is natural. We will all have some of that, depending on what situation we're dealing with and how important it is to us.
Yeah, because I can be pretty optimistic about some things and pretty pessimistic about others. It seems to be pretty situational. But I imagine that people, well, let me ask you, do you think people have a pretty good sense of where they are on the scale of optimism and pessimism? Or do they tend to think, no, I'm just realistic?
Yes. You know, that's a very interesting question. And I think part of it depends on how self-aware and in tune a person is to their own thoughts and feelings and how aware they want to get. Because I think a lot of times some of us don't want to invest too much into our thoughts. We find being with our thoughts, alone with our thoughts, a scary place to be. So self-awareness is going to obviously guide that. But also that there are a lot of like very quick inventories online where a person can easily look up, like, where do they fall on the optimism, pessimism? Asking somebody, generally speaking, do you tend to anticipate favorable outcomes when there is something is not clear how things are going to turn out? Or you can even look at pictures or images, for example, in studies, and they will show people a picture of a car accident. And then they will say, let us know what you think. How is this car accident situation going to end? The optimist will say, oh, everything will be fine. They'll get treatment. It's not as bad. Maybe they only got a few scratches. Pessimist might answer, oh, my God, things are going to be really bad. They'll never get better. They've got a lot of damage, you know, to the car, to themselves. So I think it's important for people to know, because knowing which camp you fall into is the first step to making lifestyle and mental health changes.
One of the things that always interests me, because I can be pretty pessimistic sometimes and you know, maybe see the car accident and think, oh, no, especially if I would be in it, that, oh, mm-hmm. this, you know, that it's very end of the world kind of thinking. And yet, yes. I know. Intellectually, I know things have a tendency to work out, that mm-hmm. it seldom is anything so devastating that it ruins your life. But in the moment, mm-hmm. it does seem that way.
Absolutely. And, you know, in my work as a psychiatrist and cognitive behavioral therapist, and also someone who went through cognitive behavioral therapy themselves, I can tell you that our mind wants to go to the worst a case scenario. We call it catastrophizing. These are what we call cognitive distortions. So sort of negative, skewed ways of thinking that don't always represent reality. So something like black and white thinking. It's either going to turn out perfect or it's going to go horrible. Or fortune telling, jumping to conclusions, and making assumptions about a situation, making projections, making inferences without having all the information. And what we do is, number one, you have to be aware that I have a tendency to ruminate in negative situations. I have a tendency to catastrophize, imagine the worst case. And what we found, what research has found, is that 85% of the time, things that you worry about don't actually happen. And when they do, you're better equipped to handle them than you actually gave yourself credit for. And this is a really important point for people to take home.
I get the sense that there are people who are fairly pessimistic, who believe that they just have a realistic view of the world, and they're very happy in it. And that if mm-hmm. they were to become optimistic, they kind of wouldn't know what to do with that.
Look, there is some truth to the fact that these pessimists who are walking around thinking that they're realistic, they actually are. And we know that pessimists actually have a more realistic perception and read on some situations, some of the time, than most people do. The problem is that pessimists have a tendency to engage in what we call the three P's pessimism. And this is based on the work of Dr. Martin Seligman, who, even though is one of the founders and pioneers of positive psychology, started his work and research learning about depression and pessimism. And I've added a fourth P. So the three Ps, according to Dr. Seligman, are a pessimist has a tendency to take negative things personally. They have a tendency to think negative things are permanent, and they believe that the negative event is pervasive or indicative of other aspects of their life. And as a result, my fourth P is that they become passive. And I'll give you an example. A pessimist, let's say somebody failed an exam. Let's say they're trying to get a certification as an adult and they failed. And they're like, it's me. They take it personally. I'm horrible. I suck at this. I'm never going to get better. Maybe I'm just not good at the subject. And maybe I'm just like kind of a loser. So they look at things that in the future are not going to get better and also indicative of other aspects of their life. In general, pessimists have a tendency to be realistic, but then they get mired in that negativity, and that negativity creates inaction.
My guest today is Sue Varma. She's author of a book called Practical Optimism, The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being. Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com/welcome to now.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
So, Sue, it seems to me I can't think of anybody that I know in my life that one day they're a pessimist and maybe you don't see them for a while, and a couple of months later or a couple of years later, you see them and they're all of a sudden they're an optimist. I don't have the experience of seeing people change much on this spectrum.
Yes. What I've learned over the years is how do we take all that we know about the science of optimism, right? And there really is a lot of science, Michael. It's really beautiful and it's very robust. And it's not something that I knew until many years later. And if I can share with you, my early background began working as a medical director of the 9/11 mental health program at Bellevue and NYU. And during 9/11, I was actually a trainee in a New York City hospital, and we were expecting a lot more people to come than actually did. And then years later, I was selected to be the head of this program. And I learned a lot about resilience, about the human spirit, and how some people, despite extremely tragic, horrific circumstances, not only survive, but they thrive. And I really wanted to understand, what can we learn from these folks? And then how can we take the best information and then help apply it to people who may not experience those horrific, extreme circumstances, but are still contending with daily life? And I learned that optimism has so many benefits, literally from head to toe, that it can prevent or help decrease anxiety or depression in people, of course, decreases pessimism, but also can promote a longer, healthier life. We know that optimists live on average 10 to 15% longer. They enjoy exceptional longevity. They live into their 80s with great health. They have a tendency to have less cardiac disease and less heart attacks and less strokes. And this was coming from a JAMA study, one of the most respected journals in the world, and did a meta-analysis of about 200,000 people. So I then said to myself, we have to codify what it is that these optimists are doing, and we have to make it available to everybody.
Isn't it also true, I mean, and it seems just natural and logical and obvious, that optimists are, I don't know if happier is the right word, but they seem to enjoy their life more. They're not mired in everything that's wrong. They look at what's right.
Yes, they focus on what's right, and then they maximize it. You know, So to me, it's not so important whether you have a natural tendency to look at the glass half empty or half full. I want you to know that the glass is always refillable. And what I mean by that is that there are certain things that you can do to help you, whether it is a shift in your mindset, whether it is asking for help, whether it is creating a tribe of mentors or board of advisors in your life, whether it is to creating specific healthy habits. And I call these, what I'm telling you now, as the 8 pillars of practical optimism, because some of us literally are just not going to be born or have a family environment or have a social environment where the deck is stacked against us for any number of reasons. Things are not working out, one tragedy or trauma after another. And what I learned is that you can take a certain mindset, skill set, tool set, action set, which is what practical optimism is. It's a practice, but it's something you have to practice if it doesn't come naturally to you. And I can say to you is that I still practice it. What I learned from my own cognitive behavioral therapy is that, okay, maybe I have a tendency, like you said, to look at the worst case scenario, but I don't want to dwell in my pessimism. I want to dwell in possibility. And I end up creating possibility and creating the opportunity for me to be an agent of change in my own life. And, you know, I've had many stumbling blocks along the way and many people who didn't believe in me and the possibilities that I thought as a younger person I was capable of. And there were many roadblocks and losses and grief and disappointment. But the point is, are you able to turn your stumbling blocks into stepping stones by being actionable, by being proactive? And that's how practical optimism differs from this term that we're hearing a lot about these days, is toxic positivity.
You talk about reframing, that is to change the way you look at a situation. The situation is what it is. It's how you look at it that matters and that you can change that. So talk about that.
This is something that's very hard. And I've worked with survivors of trauma for many years. And sometimes you can't because you're like, I'm not finding the silver lining in this. There is none. And I 100% respect that. And then I ask them, what is the utility of this negative thought? Because we know we can't change the situation and there's nothing good about what happened. So then what? And then that's where acceptance comes in, which I find personally one of the hardest parts. I grew up in an Eastern background philosophy household. And they would say to me, my parents would say to me, when I was ever struggling with something big, they would say, is this a problem to be solved or is it a truth to be accepted? Is it a problem to be solved or a truth to be accepted? And it was just so profound because it forces you to choose. If it's a problem to be solved, then get cracking. And if it's a truth to be accepted, then you have to sit with it.
It seems as if, from what you're saying, that the hope, it isn't either or. You're not either an optimist or a pessimist. And if you're a pessimist, you don't flip a switch. That what you're trying to do is move down the scale, is become a more optimistic, not become this wide-eyed optimist that isn't you.
Yes. Yes. To find the optimism within you and to maximize it as much as possible. Because really, it's not just about these positive outlooks in life. You want to turn those positive outlooks into positive outcomes. And so when you were asking about problem solving, like that is the next pillar, is like, I'm 100% all about do everything in your power to achieve the positive outlook that you're looking for. And part of this is anticipating obstacles and being able to work around them. And that's something I see that a lot of people don't do enough. If they are experiencing blind optimism, which is toxic positivity, everything will work out. And I'll give you an example. Let's say a person goes to the doctor and the doctor's like, you know, your cholesterol is elevated, you're borderline diabetic. And the person who's experiencing blind optimism will say, oh, everything will work out. It's fine. Doctor, you're worrying too much. Or they'll tell their partner, you're worrying too much. It's fine. And it's not fine, right? This is called the ostrich effect, where you bury your head in the sand and you think everything will work out. So we're definitely not suggesting that you end up like that. But being able to be very clear about these are the steps that I need to achieve. And this is how I'm going to get there. And this is what could potentially come in my way. And this is how I'm going to solve for it. This is the essence of problem solving. It's also important to recognize that anytime we're dealing with stress, we're contending with a battle on two fronts. One is out there in the real world, And then one is in our own mind. And we have to be actively regulating our emotions by naming, claiming, taming, and reframing. And reframing is a huge part of this. And I give people like a list of ways you can reframe your negative thoughts, whether it is asking yourself, what would I tell a friend in this situation? I'd probably be more compassionate, more kind, more caring, more understanding if a friend was dealing with this problem. Ask yourself this other question. How am I going to feel about this problem a year from now? How am I going to feel about this problem 5 years from now? Is it going to be as big of a deal as I think it now? And if it is, then you spend the time and you do your due diligence.
But almost nothing is ever as big a deal 5 years from now as it is now. I mean, it just isn't. But it's sometimes so hard to see that.
Yes.
Because you start ruminating on it. And
yes.
But even what you just said about, you know, so put health aside. You know, your health is your health. Okay, I get that. Mm-hmm. But when it does seem that you've got problems like, you know, the roof is leaking and there's a flat tire and those things all do work out. They always work out, but it's easy to get so taken over by them that you think they won't, but they always do. I mean, you can't not get your roof fixed. You can't not fix the tire. It's going to happen. Yes. It's going to be a pain in the neck. But that's another thing is you can approach it like a pain in the neck, or you can just approach it as life's handed you this, fix it and move on.
Yes, yes. And there's this great saying that, you know, I'm borrowing from someone else that says that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. And suffering is the spin, the added negative spin that we're adding to an already difficult situation.
Well, this is a lot to think about. And I think really good news, it's very hopeful that, you know, we can bring more optimism with some effort and maybe make life better. I've been speaking with Sue Varma, who is a board-certified psychiatrist in private practice, a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at New York University, and author of the book Practical Optimism, The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being. And there's a link to that book in the show notes. Thanks for being here today, Sue.
Thanks, Mike. It's been a pleasure.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you spend any time online, much of what you see or don't see is determined by algorithms. And that may make it convenient in some cases, like if you're looking for a restaurant to go to. But when you think about it a little deeper, it's a little concerning. Choices that look like yours aren't really yours. Algorithms determine what you might like, so your view of the world and of possibilities is being filtered by algorithms from social media and on shopping sites. And you haven't probably thought too much about the implications of this, but fortunately, Kyle Chaika has. Kyle is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he writes a column on digital technology and the impact of the internet on culture, and he is author of a book called Filter World: How Algorithms Flatten the Curve. Hi, Kyle. Welcome to Something You Should Know.
Thank you for having me.
So people, you know, everybody's heard of algorithms, but I don't necessarily, I know I can speak for myself, I don't necessarily know exactly how they work. I don't think most of us know how they work. So can you explain it?
It's true. I mean, how these things work is that your actions on a platform and everyone else's decisions on Facebook or Twitter are getting surveilled all the time. So the platform is figuring out what you're doing, what everyone else is doing, and using all of that data to predict what you might be interested in specifically. And in some ways that can be good. Like, you can't figure out that for yourself. You can't look at everything online and know what might be interesting to you. But I do think since algorithmic recommendations have become so dominant, it's become harder and harder to get outside of that and to actually consume things intentionally and not have your kind of horizons or perspective limited by what already is tailored to you.
Well, it seems to kind of prey on our laziness, doesn't it? It's like, you know, it makes it so much easier because, well, look, there's something we could do and I didn't have to think to come up with it.
For sure, yeah. I think a big part of this is that the internet has turned us into more passive consumers. So rather than choosing who to follow, for example, or looking for a particular kind of film or TV show on Netflix, what we're most often doing these days is following the results of algorithmic recommendations.
When we do that, I mean, I understand what you said, but is there any real harm here, or is it just, it's just kind of lazy?
I mean, I think it is lazy. It kind of robs us of some of our agency as consumers of all of this content. Music and film and visual art and literature in a lot of ways. And I think what these recommendations are doing and what our passivity is doing is making all of these forms more homogenous. Like, it's limiting the creativity of what artists can put out. It's limiting what we think of as popular or what we think of as acceptable in a given art form. We're kind of lowering it to the lowest common denominator.
You know what would be great? I can't imagine anyone's done this, but maybe they have, where you know, somebody makes their own choices and then we run the algorithm and see how their choices matched up with what the algorithm chose and and like how close was it?
It's so hard to separate what we would organically be interested in from what these feeds deliver us, just because we're given so little opportunity right now to make all of our own decisions. But I'd love to see algorithms that work differently or are more personalized to us, or that we can actually talk back to and adjust rather than just having to go with how they work at a given moment.
Is that a thing?
It's not so far. Right now, there are regulations in the EU that kind of mandate tech companies to do that. So they force tech companies to allow you to disable algorithmic recommendations, for example, or force them to make it transparent how these recommendations or feeds are working.
And how are they working? How do they? I mean, I got what you said about it looks at your behavior, and maybe that's the beginning and end of it, but how, there must be more to it than that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, each tech platform that we use, whether it's like Netflix or Facebook or, you know, TikTok feed, each of these algorithmic recommendations work differently. So the technical term for these are recommender systems. And it's basically a piece of technology that sorts through all of the content online and then picks out what might be interesting to you specifically. And so each platform has a different equation to determine which pieces of content they're going to serve up to you. And the variables are all different. They're all weighted differently. But the main one is engagement. So a piece of content that has already been popular, that a lot of people have already hit the like button on, that is going to be more likely to be served to you than a piece of content that's not so popular.
Help me understand. So if I'm watching Netflix and I watch a movie and, you know, when it's over, I get the, you know, you might like or whatever movies like this or whatever. Is it because the movies that they're recommending are like the movies I just watched, or Netflix is determining that because you like this movie, you might like these other movies because we know about you? In other words, do other people get the same five movies you might like because they watch the movie, or is there something about the algorithm that's personal to me?
It's hard to tell just how personal it is. And I think that's one of the problems with all of these systems. So for Netflix specifically, It's changed over time. So when Netflix first had recommendations, it was really tailored to you specifically. And that usually worked by a genre. So say you liked British crime dramas that take place, you know, at night. Like, it'll hone in on the very specific type of content that you like and serve you more and more of that. But I think many users, myself included, have noticed that over time, Netflix has prioritized not just what genres you like, but what content it's promoting at a given time. So now more often the Netflix homepage are things like the top 10 most viewed shows, or, you know, recently new additions for you. And these are very vague titles, and they often amount to the same five shows that everyone else is getting served as well.
Yeah, well, it also seems like if you watch a Tom Cruise movie, well, they recommend a lot of other Tom Cruise movies, and it's just because Tom Cruise is in it, not because, you know, it seems like it has more to do with the movie than with me.
Exactly. And those are different strategies for filtering content. So the Tom Cruise thing, for example, is content-based recommendation. So that's recommending it based on what is in the content that you're looking at. So if you like one Tom Cruise movie, maybe you like others. And that's different from collaborative social filtering, which works by comparing your taste to other users' taste in a much broader way. Like, the kind of constellation of different things that you like might match up with the constellation of different things that someone else likes. And then the system can use that relationship to maybe give more interesting recommendations.
Since you've looked at this, is it safe to say, even though you may not like the idea of how algorithms basically limit your choices, put that aside for a moment, are these algorithms good at what they're trying to do?
It's definitely an advanced piece of technology. Like, we all talk about AI these days, but machine learning algorithms and content recommendations are a form of AI that we've been interacting with for, you know, almost a decade now, or a decade or more. So they're very advanced, they're very smart. They are able to give very targeted recommendations. I think the YouTube algorithm is often pretty good at giving very niche specific recommendations. But I think too often now, the capability of the technology has been yoked to just the needs of the platform. So rather than Netflix digging up the most interesting obscure film that will appeal to you, it's just going to give you the latest thing that they bought the rights to. It's easier to send you another episode of The Office than it is to truly measure your personal taste and give you something new. So I think it's not that the technology is inherently bad. It's just being applied in a way that often misleads us.
When I get those kind of recommendations, I don't think of myself as all that out of the norm, but I don't just automatically believe them. I mean, one of the first things I do is look at, like, how many stars does it have? What do the reviews say? Yeah. And in other words, I'm not following people off the cliff just because people jump off the cliff, even though I'm using the algorithm as a starting point.
It's true. I mean, you have to take into account other factors and other data. And that's a good thing that you can do for yourself. Like, go one level deeper, look at reviews of a show, look at the star rating of a restaurant, maybe read a review in a newspaper or something. But I think it's algorithmic feeds have made it very easy for us to not take that extra step and just kind of believe whatever the Netflix homepage is suggesting for us.
But restaurants to me would be an example of where, you know, reviews are really important. If everybody's going there and giving it one star, well, I don't care what the algorithm says. I'm not probably going to go there.
Right. I mean, algorithmic recommendations are often built on that kind of data. So they're built on many, many user reviews and interactions on a tool like Google Maps or Yelp. And so the star ratings give you a really good idea of if that restaurant might be good or not. But you do have to think about that and kind of make a judgment for yourself. Like, making the judgment between a 3-star and a 4-star restaurant, for example, like, you may disagree with the bulk of reviewers.
Something I've always wondered about is when I like, well, movies would be the best example. So I'm watch Netflix or Amazon Prime or Prime or something, and it'll say it has 4 stars. Mm-hmm. Does everybody see 4 stars, or are they saying of people like you, it has 4 stars, or is it objectively everybody 4 stars?
It's a great question, and we don't really know. I mean, one of the problems with these systems, I think, is that they don't make the data transparent enough. And I mean, add to that the fact that a lot of data on the internet is now gamed by bots or spam accounts. So if you go on Amazon to take it away from film, you know, a toaster might have 1,000 reviews and it might be 4.5 stars, but 500 reviews of those might be fake bot reviews that the creator, the manufacturer, commissioned to make their product look better. So it's actually hard to trust all of these reviews at this point.
Really? So reviews are not a good way to go?
Well, it depends on the platform you're looking at. So there's a movie filtering social network called Letterboxd. And that has a lot of people rating their favorite films, giving them star ratings, writing little reviews. And that social network is really about individual human beings. So that's about people building up their accounts. There's very little incentive to game it. It's not about making money. It's just about people expressing their taste. And so a review site like that, I tend to really trust, but I don't really trust Amazon reviews myself at this point.
One of the things Amazon does that I've noticed is, and I don't know if this is factual or if this is just a gimmick or what, but it'll say, you know, 400 sold this month. Or 407, it's usually an odd number. It's like 473 sold this month. What is that?
I mean, it's such a surreal aspect of commerce online at this point. Like, there's so much real-time data that Amazon can show you or purport to show you how many have been sold recently. And presumably that's to argue that you should buy it too. Like, if 400 other people have bought this thing, it'll probably be okay for you too. But what does it mean? I think it's kind of ultimately a meaningless number. Like, is that a lot or a little? Do those people like that? Do they return it? You know, it actually tells you very little about the thing itself.
It seems like they wouldn't be telling you that if it was a small amount, like, right? I mean, they would
like five sold this month,
right? It never says two, right?
Yes,
it's always thousands or hundreds or something. The implication, I think, is, or the inference I take from that is, wow, that's a lot,
right? And it's meant to be convincing to you. I mean, I think a lot of these platforms essentially use data to convince you to consume that thing, whether it's accurate or to your taste or not. I mean, it's the same with TikTok videos. You know, you see a video that has 1 million views, you think it's probably going to be funny or relevant or, you know, good for you to watch it too because so many other people have liked it. But I think those metrics can work well for a commercial product like a toaster or something or a blender. Like, great, 500 other people have bought this blender. But I think it doesn't work as well for a musician's album, for example, or a film, or, you know, a niche restaurant that you might go to. I don't want to see everything ruled just by popularity.
If algorithms are doing, I mean, can't algorithms be faulty? Can't what they're telling you be baloney? Or can't the company just make stuff up? Maybe 473 Oh, yes. People didn't buy it.
For sure. I mean, there's this academic term called corrupt personalization, which means personalization that looks like it's tailored for you, but it's actually not. It's just like an illusion of that. And I think we see that, I mean, in a piece of data like the Amazon numbers, we're not sure if they're real or fake. I think lately on X, formerly known as Twitter, people have discovered that the view metrics on posts are essentially fake. Like, it's not possible that they're accurate. So there's a lot of these numbers and metrics that are being used to convince you as if they're true reflections of reality when they really are not.
Well, does anybody ask? Does anybody say, hey, Amazon, is this real, or are you making, are you absolutely certain this data is accurate? And if so, what do they say?
I don't know about investigative reporters, but I would assume that Amazon would tell you that it's true. And maybe it is true, but I think we don't have the kind of fact-checking culture or like vetted reviews in the way that we used to with consumer reports, for example, or the Wirecutter is a website that strenuously tests products on their own, and they use their own data and experiments to convince you that this thing is worthwhile. So I think there's other routes through this that rely more on direct human testing and investigation.
Yeah, well, and Consumer Reports still does that. But for, if I'm going to buy, you know, go to Amazon and buy a screwdriver or, you know, something small, and one has, you know, 5,000 five-star reviews and one doesn't, one has no reviews or two-star reviews, guess what I'm going to buy? I mean, it's not a big decision, but I might as well go with the crowd.
Totally. And in that case, it's really good for a screwdriver. Like, I find myself doing this all the time. A podcast microphone, a pair of headphones, a phone charger. Those are all easy, convenient decisions to make that you can just buy the thing with one click and be pretty sure that it'll be fine. But I think now we apply those same metrics to pieces of culture that we experience. Like, we listen to the music that the most other people listen to. We watch the videos that have already gone viral. And I think that kind of cuts out some other more unique experiences that we might have.
To which I would imagine the argument is, well, you don't have to listen to the algorithm. You can go look for your own unique, quirky, off-the-wall stuff. I mean, no one's forcing you.
Right. No one is forcing you. I mean, a big reminder of the book is that you can just log off. Like, you can get outside of these platforms and make your own decisions pretty easily. But particularly for, you know, my generation of millennials, we really grew up online and on all of these social networks. And they've often seemed inescapable, even if they aren't. So I wanted to use my writing and use this research to just remind people in part that you don't have to listen to the algorithm.
But in some cases, I mean, I use them, I think, mostly like I would use a friend recommendation. It's a tool. It's one piece of the puzzle to make a decision, but I'm not a slave to it.
Right. I mean, you're doing your own work. So you're assembling different pieces of information and using all of those to make your decision.
Depending on what it is.
Yeah. Like the screwdriver, sure, that's fine. But if you're going to a restaurant, an expensive restaurant, say, and you want to make sure this is going to work for you, you're not just going to look at a star rating. You're going to read reviews. You're going to look at their Instagram or, you know, talk to a friend who's been there. So I think I want to encourage people to do that work themselves and kind of assemble the facts yourself rather than just being passive.
But like if something like a cruise, you're going to go on a cruise, and if you don't know much about cruises, you're going to have to want to start with some sort of algorithm that gives you, or something that gives you reviews, or, you know, if you like this, you'll like that, or something that would is a starting point, because I wouldn't know where to begin. I could call a cruise company and say, so tell me about your cruises. That's going to be a long journey to get to what I want.
Totally. So I think it is a good starting point. Like booking.com is a big tourism website, and you can find flights and cruises and hotels and whatever. So a search on there is going to give you a great set of results to start looking at. But again, those are totally filtered by the number of stars that they have, the number of user ratings, you know, how many other people have liked this particular thing. So I think, again, you have to take it as the starting point rather than the end point, and not just drift to that first choice that you have in the feed.
Well, it's like we were saying at the very beginning here, it really feeds right into human laziness that, you know, well, this is the fast way to find what you're looking for. May not be the best way, but it's a pretty fast way because all these other people are doing it. And look, they recommended it. And so what more do you need?
Right. There's so much frictionlessness on the internet now that just encourages you to not think about the decision, to not talk to anyone about it, and just go with that first recommendation. And I think it works for some things. In other places, I think it's made us into worse consumers and kind of worse stewards of our own tastes and preferences and life experiences.
Well, I wanted you to come on and talk about this because, this is something I've never really thought about, that all these algorithms are really limiting my options, limiting my choices. I've always thought of it as a convenience, but this is a different way of looking at it that I think is, it's eye-opening. I've been speaking with Kyle Chaika, who is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and the name of his book is Filter World, How Algorithms Flattened Culture. And there's a link to his book at Amazon in the show notes. Thanks for coming on today, Kyle.
Thanks so much, Mike. It was fun to be here.
This may sound hard to believe, but driving with a cold can be more dangerous than driving drunk. Researchers compared the reaction times of cold sufferers with the reaction times of people with alcohol blood levels above the legal limit. The results found that cold sufferers have even lower alertness levels than those who had been drinking. Those people who were suffering from a cold had a tendency to follow too closely and took longer to stop the car. When your body is fighting an infection, memory and movement can be impaired, regardless of the severity of the sickness. And on top of that, if you add in a sneeze, you're increasing the risk. A sneeze can take your eyes off the road for as much as 3 full seconds. And that is something you should know. If the opportunity comes up in your conversations with other people, it would be greatly appreciated if you would mention this podcast and ask those people to give a listen. I'm Mike Carruthers. Thanks for listening today to Something You Should Know.